So the Clarityite group did embrace those who were in the union movement, and we just naturally became organizing socialists, and this is where we found our natural niche. And all of Michigan was in the trade union section of
that. So the alignment was viewed more in terms of the differences in strategy than more than the differences in ideology. So there was not really debate within the Michigan group or within the same group of should they go with this faction or that. It just evolved from the position on trade unionism, in other words.
Yes, that's why we, in Flint, and I'm sure in Detroit also, well, Flint I specifically, that's why we vote we're in the Clarity Group. Also, the Clarity Group was formed to bring clarity between the Trotskyists, I understand, who had entered the movement, and the Thomasites, and there was a lot of friction, and I think this group was to bring clarity in the SP and to make these negotiations with the Trotskyists, who I guess were pretty militant and came in as an organized, a well-organized group.
But at this point, you were not really familiar with that.
I didn't know any Trotskyists.
Well, you know, was the Clarity Group, or that you identified verbally as part of the Clarity Group,
yes.
And it was clear to you and
yes.
to the group that there was a faction.
Because
that
they were the ones who were the correspondence with our group on our activities and so on. The Thomas group didn't weren't too interested in local actions again. I don't know what the role of the Thomas group was in New York, but we didn't have much contact with them in Michigan.
Well, it seemed like part of the definition of the Clarity group was viewing themselves as a revolutionary vanguard party. Did you view yourself in those terms, or was that very foreign to you at that point?
No, because it always translated in the terms that we were going to have a labor party. The Revolutionary Vanguard Party, we conceived of coming through perhaps the form of a labor party or a popular party like the Debs movement. I think that's the way we conceived of it, and we knew that it had to be masses of workers. So at least that's the way it translated in our minds at the time.
Now, since the entire Michigan Socialist Party group is basically identified as the Clarity
caucus,
there were no internal debates during the strike among yourselves. There was not a factional debate within the Socialist Party group.
Yes, in Michigan.
Now, did the effect of the strike have any effect on your ideology? Do you think? Did you begin to change any of your ideas?
Oh, yes.
The result of the strike in terms of socialism?
Yes, I did. When I wrote the letter to Norman Thomas appealing for a decision on pulling Plant 4, and he threw it over to Frank Traeger, and I saw Frank Traeger, who was a very intelligent man, come into Flint, and he was just overawed, and he thought everything was so dramatic. He was duly impressed, and I'm not trying to denigrate him in any way, but he had to listen to the arguments on both sides, and I thought he made a correct decision. Of course, to me, he was a very great man for that, reason. But he had not actually come out of the working class himself. He didn't. He made it on an intellectual level, the decision. He didn't immediately sense. The needs. There was something about the whole Clarity leadership. Gus Tyler wound up with the LWG, International Lady Garment Workers, but at that time I think he was just out of NYCC, or going, I don't know which. Herbert Zam had some other kind of a job outside of mass production industry. Frank Traeger, again, was not ever in mass production industry. And I think that probably the strike itself made me feel that I would like to have had some kind of a leader. Luther was had no time to go over and become a leader of the Socialist Party. He already had his ambitions in the labor movement and his experience and his orientation augmented to the labor movement. But that we needed somebody within the Socialist Party that had the experiences of a Roy Ruther or somebody like that. And I think it was proposed at one point that one of the Ruther brothers come over to be a part of the leadership of the Clarity Caucus of the Socialist Party, or perhaps even a national elected officer of the Socialist Party. But Walter Reuther distinctly put thumbs down on that. No, he wanted no political labels put on the root name Reuther. And I think it was Roy Reuther who was whom they wanted to become a leader of the Socialist Party of America. Now, had that transpired, I would have been very, very happy. I would have felt that this party then, because he had been an educator of workers, would have had the direction to, you know, focus all of its attentions and energies on the education of the mass production worker.
So actually, by the time you were in the sanitarium and had gotten the literature from Trotsky, you were beginning to feel some disillusionment then with the Socialist Party, it sounds like.
Perhaps I was. It was sort of nebulous in my mind. I don't know if it was well defined. And then in reading a little of the literature of the Trotskyist movement, some of it was very alien to me. It took me a long time to understand why did we have to be fighting the battles of the Soviet Union. And yet, at the same time, when I read about the history of the Russian Revolution for the first time, and then I began to get into some of Trotsky's writings. He did have a keen and brilliant mind, no question about it. He was born in the wrong period for such a mind as that. I was impressed, but I had no idea of coming home and joining the SWP. But because I had been receptive to the point that I would read the opposing position, I have never been a real bitter factionalist. I could never be. At the next convention, then also, I remember a little red-headed woman by the name of Sylvia Bleeker, who was married to Morris Stein for many, many years. And because she retained her own name, and because she got up on the floor and spoke as I can remember no other woman in the SP ever doing, disagreeing with her own husband, disagreeing with James Buchanan, disagreeing with anybody, she was there as an individual. I had so much respect for that little woman. She came and sat next to me in the convention.
Oh, so this is when the Trotskyists were still within the party, then?
Yes, yes. And she talked to me, and I couldn't get that woman out of my mind. I was so impressed with her, much more, of course, than any of the men were impressed with her. I understand she's still alive. She was a tremendously fine person. And she came over to sit down and talk to me, and I erased the feelings of, I had the feelings that this foreign element came in to get our party all split up on the question of the Soviet Union. And that was the main point of contention right then within the party. Then I came back to Flint. I did not join the SWP at the convention. Now, what convention would that have been? God only knows.
It probably would have been 37, because the expulsions began in 37, and they actually formed the SWP in 38 after the expulsions.
But I didn't go out. They expelled the Trotskyists, but I didn't go out with the Trotskyists. So I wasn't expelled from the SWP. It was after I came back from the sanatorium, 37 convention, maybe I met Sylvia Bleeker then. Then when I came back from the sanatorium in 38, there was contact made by a man by the name of George Clark, who had been working with and in the factories in Detroit with the auto workers of Detroit and an Italian young man and some other auto workers there. I'm very personable, and they made contact with me. All right, I'll read your literature, but I don't think I want to join.
They were actively recruiting you.
Oh, yes. They were up in Flint every weekend, I think. And I got bored, and at one point I threw him out. And I said, I haven't had time. Don't rush me, and I don't like this idea, and so on. And then they made arrangements. They said, well, would you mind talking to Vincent Dunn, who had just gone through this great truck driver's strike in Minneapolis, which had impressed everybody and the auto workers also. And would you mind talking to him? Well, here was a man who was one of the big men of labor in my eyes. And he and a man by the name of Vincent Skoglund, who came from Sweden and had been a worker all of his life in Minneapolis, came from Minneapolis to Flint. And they talked so convincingly, and we talked about how to educate the worker and how to recruit the worker. And they talked in terms of truck drivers and other workers that were around the labor movement there. And even though their strike was not of the significant hours was, nevertheless, it was one of the forerunners. And the women had played a very extensive role there, too, on a different level. It was still under the guidance and direction of the men in the strike, but nevertheless, they played a very important role.
Were they trying to recruit just you or Kermit as well and your whole group, or was their focus primarily on you?
Well, they knew that whatever I did would probably have a lot of effect in the SP, but their tactics after that were very poor. I'll tell you why. So they asked, would we please come to Minneapolis? Oh, we had no money. All right, we'll pay the expenses. I remember going over on the boat and seasick all night long. My God, that was a terrible thing on the Great Lakes. And we went to Minneapolis, and there we met Grace Carlson, a very personable person who later ran for vice president of the United States. And she told me her story of leaving the Catholic Church and coming over. And she talked in workers' terms also, even though she had never worked in a factory.
I think she had a PhD in something.
Yes, she was. Dr. Grace Carlson, she was. And she was, she seemed like a very stable and firm person after that. You know, she went back to the church with her husband and everything else. But,
you know, when you say we, when you went to Minneapolis.
Kermit went with me.
Did Carl Johnson go too?
No.
You and Kermit.
Kermit and me, uh-huh. Carl Johnson was a dyed-in-the-wool idealist, and he felt that Norman Thomas, he was in the clarity group. But there was never any factionalism in his mind between the Clarity Group and the Thomasites or anything else. Mm. Norman Thomas was the man that the mantle of socialism fell on in America. So Carl Johnson didn't even want to read the literature. He was a great reader, too. He read the papers, some of the papers and so on. But he thought the whole issue of bringing the Soviet Union over here was a divisive thing in the American working class.
So you and Kermit went?
Yes, we went.
Yes.
And, of course, they had a very active group. They had very large meetings. They had a very large Minneapolis headquarters. And each person, one after another, was a worker that I admired because they were on a much higher educational level, having been years in this, having years on us, and not having been quite so isolated in a small town like we were. So I was very, very impressed with all of the people that I met there. I remember big, tall Hank, somebody from the electrical workers and other workers that came in. And I thought, oh, this is what we should have. And they were very honest people. They were not like, for instance, Walter Reuther, who felt like he was labor's elite.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to be controlled at all from the ranks of the Socialist Party. He didn't want anybody in the party to tell him. They were leaders in their own right, and yet you could see in a meeting which we attended that the guy who set up the chairs had, and his name was Oscar Coover, by the way, set up the chairs had as much to say in that meeting, and his opinions were as respected as anybody else's, Vincent Dunn or anybody else. So we were very, very impressed, and when we came back, we decided perhaps that we might be able to work better with people like that than with, well, I was already very disillusioned with Walter Reuther, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And
you and Kermit seem to see eye in eye.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to say that I was disappointed, disillusioned. Kermit was too, because he felt very, very strong about the worker having a right to talk to the top leader, and especially after Walter Reuther had made these beautiful statements, he believed no official of any union. That includes the garment workers, the miners, and all the established unions, should ever be paid more than the highest paid skilled worker in the industry. So Kermit felt very strongly that Reuther wasn't acting the way he was speaking at that point, even though we were in the same caucus. So we decided that perhaps they were right. They had a marvelous trade union program in Minneapolis and nationally, and the militant, although it still seemed alien in some of its language, and I never got over that feeling entirely, we decided to join. And then they became insistent, as Cannon, I later learned, was insistent. He wanted to use this nationally, that that Kermit Johnson, strike leader, you know, the other strike, and Genora Dow and Genora Johnson had come over to the Socialist Workers Party. They were using this to bring other workers out of the SP across the country and to recruit. And so they made the announcement far too soon, because we could have taken every member of the Socialist Party branches had they given us the time.
Well, you came back then from Minneapolis and started talking within your own Socialist Party group.
Yes, but the announcement was made too soon, and they hesitated, and again they were hit by this Trotskyist. Why do you have to say we're Trotskyist? This was a fight that happened, you know. They were not at the level of reading that we were. And with Carl Johnson remaining firm, and the people that I had recruited then were working very actively in the union, and they knew what it meant to have a label like a Stalinist on you and a Trotskyist and so on. And we did not, when we went into the party, we did not bring over more than Kermit's brother, Eugene, who was just a good guy. You know, would go anywhere his brother and his sister-in-law said. His brother Eugene and a couple of other people. Mm-hmm. Couldn't have been very important, I would have remembered. And then he started recruiting.
Then you formed the nucleus. Were there other people who were already in the party in Flint? Or
no.
You were the beginning of it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there animosity on the part of the SP people who didn't really toward you and Kermit about
only it? One. And this was the young man that I told you I turned over the sign painting department when we were organizing. I recruited him into the SP. His name is Bruce Sloan. And Bruce Sloan was so bitter. He was so brokenhearted. He was so hurt that he was very, very bitter. And he wrote a very bitter letter to the national office and good riddance and so on and so forth. But the rest of them, no. And they were never hostile. They were hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Terribly hurt, because it was a bad tactic.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why it was announced that way. I don't know if I had any control over it. I don't remember how it happened, but it was bad tactics. So we didn't bring over the people. We did recruit a lot of people, though.
And from what kind of groups were they recruited then?
Well, now the main part, oh no, that came later. That came after Saul came back to Flint. Saul was in the Socialist Workers Party in New York. And Saul went with Kermit and just met all the workers.
Mm-hmm.
And he recruited some very fine, influential mm-hmm. people. And not only that, but later on, when he went back to Flint, the second time he established, and I say he here because he was a full-time on this.
Mm-hmm.
He acted full-time on this.
But earlier, when you and Kermit first started the party, you were recruiting primarily from other UAW people then?
I don't know if we were recruiting so much as just having discussions. I don't remember
mm-hmm.
the joining, really the building the movement up until after the whole Detroit experience mm-hmm. and our coming back. Then that's when we added.
The WPA thing was part of building also.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that Roy Lawrence and Claude Workman and Robert Carter, who later became a city manager in the city of Flint, we brought them into the our orbit,
mm-hmm.
the Socialist Workers Party orbit. They were members.
Well, then until the WPA organizing, how many of you would there have been who would be
there? How many until the WPA? Oh, Patrick Murphy and his son. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There must have been maybe 10 or 12.
Mm.
And because of our union activities, unemployed, and WPA activities, the Martin fight, and everything else, we didn't have the chance to sit down and educate and go through the whole business of the labor movement and the socialist movement and everything else. You see, we had little period of preparation prior to the big strike
mm-hmm.
to just sit down and talk about the path of labor. And these people, we didn't have, we would do it whenever we could. Mm-hmm. We'd meet together in small meetings and do what we could. But most of our discussions would go right over into the present day mm-hmm. emergency problems.
So there was this period then between 38 and the WPA organizing and 39 where you were just kind of building this group and still involved in the UAW
yeah.
until the
yes.
and the WPA.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, General, when was the Michigan Commonwealth Federation? Is this quite a bit later?
This was when I was in when Sal and I were in Detroit.
Oh,
so that comes later.
Okay, what then?
We were advocating the Labor Party, well, I think from the beginning.
Let me make a note of that. We'll get into it. So then we get to, you're in the WPA, or you're both in the Socialist Party at this point. When was Kermit laid off his job at GM in this period and went into the WPA? Do you recall?
No, I don't recall.
Because it seems like in the WPA...
I think if there was somewhere we could look up, I think that all of Chevrolet went down for retooling, for war production. Well, I'm not sure. Whether that happened to Fisher, because they went over into producing tanks, and Chevrolet, I can't remember whether it was Jeeps or what.
Because the first, it seems like it was in about March, April of 39 that the WPA union began.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if this was a plan for Kermit to go into the WPA section to organize the local, or what was the actual sequence and how the organizing began?
What do you mean a plan for him to do? No, it all was developed very naturally. But he was laid off in the natural process mm-hmm. according to his seniority.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, he didn't have, because of his youth, he didn't have high seniority
mm-hmm.
in the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So he would have been one of the first ones to be laid off. Then the natural thing after that was to go on unemployed. We didn't have any benefits then
mm-hmm.
from the union, naturally. It was to go on relief because there were no other jobs. This
mm-hmm.
was a one industry town. And or where the WPA was opening up work projects for you to go on relief until you could get taken on a work project. This is a very natural and very normal development. And with the Workers' Alliance beginning to attract people, we didn't feel that they had the answers to the very, very crucial problems. And so this is when the UAW internationally, I think, set up a department. Now, they never pushed that because I think they understood that it was a temporary thing much more than we did. We weren't sure. We'd been in a depression period in this one industry town
mm-hmm.
for so long, and we felt it so deeply that we weren't sure of the duration, so we went at it hammer and tongs when we organized the unemployed.
Now,
and also...
You were living on relief then?
Yes, we were for a short period of time until he got on a WPA project.
And you were still living in your parents' apartment there?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure about that. There were other places that we lived also. I can't tell you that for sure. It's getting kind of hard now. Our participation in this whole development, I do know this also, that when the UAW set up its WPA locals to organize the men on the jobs, these were auto workers that had been organized in the strike, and and they wanted to keep representing them, showing them the value of organization, unionization. They were not too crazy about having the unemployed, because there are in every city always certain number of relief cases that, that will always be with you. They were not too crazy about that. And we felt that the problems were so interrelated that you could not possibly exclude them. Now, the WPA workers had to pay something like 25 cents a month dues, some very small amount, but it's significant as far as operating a union hall and, and running off leaflets and things like that, the unemployed had to pay nothing. So as far as the union was concerned, it was just you're operating at a loss when you had to put out leaflets to reach the unemployed also. And we felt that the problems were so interlinked between the unemployed, the WPA, and the factory workers that this was our distinct role there in the city of Flint. And the Workers' Alliance wanted the Workers' Alliance for the Workers' Alliance. You know what I mean? They didn't try to tie it up with any of the UAW demands, nor it was done from the headquarters. And nationally, they were the big unemployed organization, no question about it. And theirs was always done from their national headquarters all the way down into.
But the original impetus then for organizing the WPA workers actually came from the UAW leadership within Flint, anyhow.
It was from pressure, rank and file pressure in the UAW, yes, that set up this department within the UAW. And as soon as we had our groups meeting, you know, always we were, I can't explain this to you so much, Sherna, because there's been nothing like it since. Always there were meetings going on, whether our little socialist groups or like thinkers or a big poker party or whatever, there were groups that were meeting, maybe not the same groups all of the time. So we had methods of communication from the strike days.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the guys would just meet together in the beer gardens. Very often I was with them in beer gardens. I never particularly liked them. They were noisy, smoky places. But very often I would go with them. And we would sit until long hours in the morning, you know, discussing unionism, union. That was all we were always thinking about. So as soon as we heard about the department, I think, it's when we decided we wanted to get that official title and we wanted to tie up what we had been discussing and how we had been operating. We had never gone to the Workers' Alliance, so maybe some of them had gone up there to see about it. But it was something that we just didn't seem to gravitate to. And as soon as the UAW had an umbrella that we could operate under, this is what we wanted.
Now, by we, you mean who?
I mean the workers in Buick and Chevrolet and Fisher and the other plants that had just sort of been friends. Friendships were formed and groups were formed during the period of strike in the Penn Deli building, you know.
So this was, because there was a reference in recounting the history of that local to a half a dozen militants who would really work on organizing it early. And I was just wondering who those people were, and were these all people tied to the FWP at that point,
It must have been, yes, because
it seems like even the very first demonstration, Claude Workman was the spokesman at Kermit.
Claude Workman was from Buick. No, we didn't meet Claude Workman until the WPA.
Mm-hmm.
He was out on some project, but perhaps by the time the UAW set up, maybe I think Kermit was already on a WPA project. Mm-hmm. So this is where they met them on their projects too. Pat Murray was on then projects. You know what these big work projects were, where they were making streets, opening ditches, and, you know, you just call it boondogging. But anyway, all of these, they were really with pick and shovel.
Mm-hmm.
And a work project might be a very large component of men. These were all males that were out on these kind of jobs. And then that project would be finished, and half of it would go over here, perhaps 20 blocks away, and another one would go on the other side of the city. But these people kept in touch because of their need to discuss their problems, and because they had been in the strike situation. Every one of them had some way or another participated in the strike situation. Claude Workman from Buick, his plant was never on strike, but he was down there on the picket line.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew Kermit Johnson, and Kermit Johnson and me, we were sort of focal points of getting, you know, all these people, we were sort of, I don't know, you know, if we're And we had this apartment that our places that people would come up very often just to talk on a Saturday night. We've got a problem and get a couple of bottles of beer and that. But we even had to collect was it milk bottles or something that you turned in, got 2 cents for return sometimes to get a couple of bottles of beer or a bottle of beer. And I don't know, we just had no money. We had to collect milk bottles and all kinds of things and pool them mm-hmm. in order to get a beverage to drink, to just sit around and talk.
Well, then, in other words, but the UAW, as these men from with the strike background started working on the WPA project, and the UAW was recognizing the need to keep a kind of spirit of unionism,
mm-hmm.
this local auxiliary was set up.
The pressure came from the ranks on the UAW. Mm-hmm. That's the main point that I do remember. Okay, so it was set up. This department was set up.
And was it set up with the sewer system and all the rest of that, or did that evolve later?
This is the natural pattern, because that was the way the UAW was operating at that point. You see, we had a steward system in the plants at mm-hmm. that time. So naturally, we appointed a man as a steward on every single work project around the city.
Now, what proportion would you think actually joined the local? Do you recall what the figures were ever?
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I know that many of them felt that they couldn't pay the 25 cents mm-hmm. a month, I think it was. Was it a week? They just felt they couldn't pay the dues, and whenever they would call a strike on a project, and of course we did this in order to get job conditions or whatever was necessary. They'd call a strike on a project, the men would sit down to a man, even if they couldn't afford to drive into the meetings of this union or pay the dues of this union. And there were, I don't know of anybody that were actually scabs on the job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, within the organization, we had a couple of men that stood out in my mind. One was the one we elected the first president, a little guy by the name of Ed Weber, and another man by the name of Joseph Dupre. And they were contacted by city officials and other people, making them feel a little bit prominent. They were used within our union to try to get up and hold down the militancy.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, I think they used Joseph Dupre, who I was very suspicious of and from more than one angle, expel myself and Roy Lawrence, and I thought mm-hmm. Kermit was expelled at the time, too.
But that was the end of 1940, then, already.
Yeah. But the point that I'm making is that the men on the job,
mm-hmm.
Whether they belonged to the union or not, really felt that they were part of whatever action
mm-hmm.
was called upon. That's why we had these leaflets going out every single week, and sometimes more than if it was an emergency situation or we had something special.
Mm-hmm. So there were stewards on each project
yes.
And then the local would print up leaflets
mm-hmm.
that the stewards would distribute on the job.
Yes. We would go and have somebody in a car go around mm-hmm. and give a batch to each steward, and they would distribute them on the job.
So this was still all, at this point, in the early organizations, it was still with the blessings of the UAW that was influenced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was the group of militants, though, who forced it to be WPA and an employee.
Yes, of course, we made that decision. I don't know what they did in the other WPA locals. Again, we had our hands full. It's not easy to communicate when you haven't got money for telephone, you haven't got time for lights, writing letters. Joe Pagano didn't come into Flint until he decided we were a little too militant. We went down to Detroit to see him one time because he was sending letters up there and making impossible demands that weren't related to the situation, but
was the incorporation of the unemployed in the local partially as a response to what the workers' alliance was doing and their attempt to recruit among the unemployed?
It may have been, but again, you see, the man who was on unemployment was just waiting to get on a project in WPA. And the man who perhaps had been hurt or couldn't continue on WPA or something like that would be back on unemployment. Or if he was on WPA, he had sisters and brothers and other family people who were unemployed and having a hell of a time with the relief administration. So there was this feeling of family between the two groups, and then, remember, they were all ex-auto workers in Flint. Mm-hmm. And they just felt as though, we've got to help each other, like the auto workers were backing us at every point. And some of them, even when they got their paychecks in the factory, would come over and say, how's the leaflet fund? And here's an extra 50 cents, or here's a dollar, which for them was a big sacrifice because they had accumulated debts to the point that things were being repossessed, their articles of furniture, their radios, or cars, or whatever. And they made big sacrifices. And some of the auto workers would come to our Saturday night dances and, you know, encourage everybody. Look what we did in the shops, and if it picks up again, you'll be in with us, and we're going to support you. So there was a feeling of unity, just a general feeling that would have been very difficult to draw a line, say this is only WPA workers.
Because in going through it, it doesn't seem to me that in most other cities it was combined. That seemed to be somewhat unique in Detroit.
Well, you see, in Detroit, the unemployed would be almost lost. But Flint was a one industry town, and you were just in the process of either being or not being an auto worker.
Mm-hmm.
And in Detroit, there were other little odd jobs that they could get, you know, in different departments of the city or whatever, hospitals or things like that. Or going over into the unemployed, and they lived so many miles away from the plants, you know, and the workers in Detroit. Entirely different in Detroit. The unemployed could get lost.
Mm-hmm. But there was
and remember, this was a General Motors town, too.
Mm-hmm.
And Chrysler workers, the General Motors workers had two entirely different strike situations. They didn't have the same acquaintanceships and, you know, rapport. And
well, was there a real fight within the UAW then when you wanted to incorporate the unemployed with the WPA workers?
No, not at that point. I think they were annoyed, but I don't think they thought it was that important.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they thought really anything that we did. There was not too much attention paid on WPA unemployed. And I'll have to sit down and try to analyze that sometime. I might have had some ideas at the time, but there wasn't too much until they felt that we got too militant.
Now, you were elected as the recording secretary from the beginning, or were there first temporary offices? Or were those, do you recall?
I was the only recording secretary, I think, of the whole thing. Mm-hmm.
And the Roy Lawrence?
Well, because, right.
Roy Lawrence, in the beginning, was one of the officers, too, or was that in 40 when they tried to get rid of both of you that she came in?
I think Roy Lawrence came in later.
Mm-hmm. But Claude Wolfman, permit met on a job.
Mm-hmm.
And then Anne was involved. He seems to be involved very early.
Yes, he was.
That very first demonstration that he was already involved.
He was already part of the project workers and the bringing together. And if Roy Lawrence himself was not actually in from the beginning, he came from a little suburb town called Mount Morris. And there was a whole crew of Mount Morris workers that many of them worked in Buick because that was the closest to their end of town. Roy Lawrence worked in AC, which was at their end of town also. And there was a whole crew of this little town was pretty cohesive. They knew everybody, you know, and so on. And it was just right outside the city. And Pat Murray, yes, Pat Murray was one of the original ones, an older man. Roy Lawrence may have been, but I don't think he was an officer from the beginning.
Well,
I think Pat Murray was.
What was the relationship of the early group of you who were involved in the local to the SWP? Was the entire organizing group already involved in the SWP?
No.
Was there a connection between the local?
No, while we were building the local, we were building the SWP simultaneously. And there was just a lot of respect because of our strike activities. So Claude Workman and Pat Murray and Roy Lawrence and all of these other people that I have named, with the exception of Ed Weber and Joseph Dupre and I can't think of any others, though, that we didn't recruit as we were building the WPA Local 12.
So it was the other way around, rather than becoming...
But as I say, when I say recruit, yes, we signed them up, and yes, they did read the Millicent. They didn't understand, though, the whole business of why they were Trotskyists, or why did you have to use that name. They preferred to say we're socialists, we belong to the Socialist Workers' Party. They had the real American approach, that the rest of it, you know, that was beyond them. If we said that something was right, it was right, and we didn't have the opportunity to sit down and have any political discussions during this time.
So the discussions were primarily about the relief measures, about the cut in WPA, because that's the day-to-day. What was the, as you were first forming in the spring of 39, what was that initial relationship with the Workers' Alliance? Because it becomes clear later on that there...
We tried on occasion to have United Front demonstrations, because they did have the foreign-born people, and they did have... It was an older established union, and they were known in the beginning. When we weren't, we had to go out on the project. And when we went out on the project, of course, many of them related to the UAW-CIO, a Local 12 label of whale of a lot better than the Workers' Alliance. And so we became greater, bigger than they did. And in the beginning, when we wanted to have some joint demonstrations, they, who were we anyway? They ignored us completely. And then they sent people down into our meetings saying, well, we have the big dances. And it's true. They had the big potlucks. They had a lot of foreign-born women that would put on the dishes and so on. And some of the people from our union used to go up there just for the dances, but come back for the business end of our meeting, too. So in the beginning, they didn't think that we were... any significant factor. Later, when we became larger than they, then they were more interested in sending people in to try to raise questions that we could handle them all easily. It made no difference, and sometimes we won them over, so that wasn't... but then they wouldn't meet because they felt that we were a rival organization, and if we had a United Front, we might take more of their members away.
Well, were they actually trying to go to the WPA projects and organize the WPA? Or was their concentration primarily with the...
No. They were giving us competition all up and down the line.
So they had been... So in your literature, for instance, was talking about the Workers' Alliance compared to the WPA?
No, we tried to keep away from getting into that factional thing. Because even in the UAW at this time, the Martin and Thomas thing, you know, we were involved in all of these things going on. And we were more interested in this big UAW international, what was happening inside of that, even at the same juncture. And we didn't want to get into, we'd get up and in our speeches say, look what we have won for you. Mm-hmm. The Workers' Alliance wasn't able to. And we could point to many things like this. So we had, I think the cards were stacked on our side.